Episode 10, Allied Action Podcast. Frank Chi is here with us.
What's up?
You're in Brooklyn right now?
I am in Brooklyn, New York.
Are we here maybe not for long?
Yeah, you know, probably not. I'm one of those people who, like, I might have moved to New York a little too late. I spent 15 years in D.C. My friends used to make fun of me and say, you used to threaten to move to New York all the time. And I finally did it. And I got here. I'm like, I probably need to be in L.A. So, you know, that will probably happen soon.
Well, Matt and I are excited for the moment you're here. And we're also humbled that you joined us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And, you know, I'll just kind of give a little bit of a bio. But I think Matt and I always prefer having our guest say a little bit more about themselves as opposed to us doing it, because I don't know if we'll ever do the bio justice. So I like to personalize it a bit. But Frank, you and I met almost 2.5 years ago now, I think.
Yeah.
Through Carrie Twigg and this amazing band of, you know, Obama White House folks that really came out of that time and decided that they were going to really shift and shape culture through storytelling. Mm-hmm. And you have since done that in many ways. And I think ways that people don't realize, because your face and name isn't like on them, as an example, like Notorious RBG. Can't wait to talk about that. You created the Notorious RBG, right?
Me and my friends. I wasn't the only one, but that was a fun time.
Yeah. May she rest in peace. But excited to have you on to talk all things 38 at the Garden, but also really what that movie is about, where it comes from, and you know, your dedication to storytelling as it pertains to the spaces of you know, allyship and giving people, I guess, not license so much as information and entertaining capsules.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of red meat and some vegetables sprinkled in. That's the way I usually like to look at the work that I do, you know?
Amazing. Well, I'll give you the floor to kind of do a little bit of an intro for the people. And then Matt and I will just dive in. We like these to be conversational, right?
Yeah. Matt? Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I'm coming off of the campaign trail, so I have had no shortage of just talking about me and just how I got to filmmaking and how I got to sort of just finding what is the right intersection between art, culture, and politics. How does storytelling weave all of that together? And, you know, obviously I do mostly film now, but I've done a lot of artistic collaborations. Writing, I mean, just all forms of storytelling to me are important for the way we have this conversation about, you know, obviously part of this is allyship, but this is at its core about pluralism, right? About creating an inclusive society where people, no matter whether you feel like you're in the majority or the minority, just feel like you are included and have a voice. If you look at the through line on all of the work that I do, that is the through line, right? It's making sure that people feel like they have a space to feel comfortable in America. A little bit of background on me. I am an immigrant kid. I came here when I was 7 from China. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was always one of those kids, whether it was, you know, whatever school I was at, whatever city I lived in, I just never felt like I belonged. Right. I was like in high school, I was like a wallflower. If you ask people who went to high school with me, like what you thought Frank Chi was going to be, they'll probably be like, who? Right. Like, you just didn't know who I was. And like, that was part of like just feeling very insecure about my place in society. When I was in college, the summer before my sophomore year, I went to Boston for the Democratic National Convention and I heard Barack Obama speak. And my friends will tell you this, I used to be able to recite The Audacity of Hope by heart. It changed my life. And to me, right afterwards, I just dove headfirst into politics. And it was an act of belonging, right? Like, you know, hope of a of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. I just had never had somebody give me permission to belong, whether it was my personal life or on like a major societal level. And I got very into politics. I got like very deep into college Democrats. I want to do political communication. And when I was graduating, I had two dreams. One, I wanted to make political ads. And two, I wanted to work for Barack Obama, who had just announced he was running for president. And I look back on it now, and I still can't believe this. I got the dream job. I got to work on the Obama media team, making Obama's ads straight out of college in Washington, D.C. This was 2007, right? He didn't look like he was going to win. But I got to be there for the roller coaster of him just... I mean, I still remember when we first got there, it looked like he was going to lose to Hillary, and Obama had taken the advertising, the script writing role away from the team, being like, I'm going to write them, right? And like, they were not that good. So people have to be like, okay, all right, now you've proven that these ads aren't really hitting. Let's take our responsibilities back. So like, that was like the universe in which I was heading into. And then obviously, momentum shifted in Iowa, and when he won and then later won the whole thing, you can imagine what that does to someone like me, right?
How old are you at this time frame?
I'm 23. When he wins, I'm 23. And I was like, this whole journey of belonging that he took me on, like, we won. Like, he's president. I got to work on it. I'm living in Washington, D.C. Now I'm going to go work for other clients who are in politics. I'm going to keep on doing political ads. At the time, like, the internet wasn't the way it is. So it's like political advertising. It's not content. It's not digital, right? And it was like one of the most like enthralling experiences I have ever had. My friends, when we lived in our like flop house in D.C. during that time, we talk about 2008, we all start crying, right? Because like, it's just woven into like this moment that felt impossible, the impossible moment, the OG impossible moment, right? A Black man becoming president of the United States, especially a son of immigrants, right? And I really, that feeling, like, it carried with me for a really long time. I always say, like, it was a clean decade. My euphoria from the Obama experience, it was August 2004 when I heard that speech, and to the day in August 2014 when I saw the Verge Ferguson trend on Twitter, right? It's a clean decade for me where I felt like I lived in this world where I won, where I got to work. I mean, my political experience during that time was sort of charmed too, right? I got to work for Elizabeth Warren, who I met as a Harvard law professor who needed someone to take care of her Facebook account because she was blowing up and didn't know what to do, right? And
that's how you met Elizabeth Warren?
I met her, yeah. And like, she was at the Roosevelt Institute at the time as a fellow and just took over TARP oversight for Harry Reid in the Senate right after the recession started, right? And like, I was like a friend who went to law, who was one of her law school students, was a friend of mine, was like, Frank knows the internet, let him run your Facebook group. And like, this is 2010. 2009, 2010, like right after her Daily Show experience. And I was on that ride. That was the first real campaign where I had true responsibility. Like, I'm not going to pretend like I was like writing Obama's ads. I was like getting coffee and billing people, right? Like, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like I was doing the real work. So like, I got to do that. I worked on like over a dozen house races I worked on five Senate races. I built my own political consulting shop, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then when that experience ended for me, especially at first, because I think of the smartphone era, it's sort of just unveiling a lot of America's problems, but then the backlash to that, which is sort of Trumpism, right? And when that happened to me, I was off that joyride, and from somebody who was always behind the scenes, never put my name on anything. That was during that stretch, that charmed era is when me and my friends made Notorious RBG, right? Like, I felt like after that, I needed to start putting my name on things because people are questioning my very existence in this country. And starting in 2015, I started making short films, and I started making sort of content in general that had my name on it at the end. right? That were about sort of all every single social justice related issue under the sun at the time, whether it's immigration, whether it's police reform, whether it's, I mean, the threat to Roe at the time was like just starting really, you know, like bubble in the way that we see it now, right? And like every single right that we took for granted, that we thought we had won,
right,
was just coming under attack. And when it culminated in Trump winning, I think that experience, it made me much more comfortable in saying my voice and my face attached to it and what I create is a lot more important than what kind of client roster I have in politics to say, oh, this is how I matter, right? That's very much actually like end of 2015 is when I met Carrie, right? When we all, I mean, like she and I have sort of been on this journey together about going from politics to culture, understanding the power of storytelling and weaving it all together. I think from there, you know, in 2015, I put out a video with Color of Change and Danny Glover called Kids Who Die. It was using Langston Hughes's poem, Kids Who Die, from the 1930s. And we wove it together with modern day Black Lives Matter protest imagery. And that was like the first thing I ever did that I was like, oh my God, like, okay, like this isn't a client telling me, oh, I need to do this. Tell me the best way to do it. This is like, okay, we have an idea. Let's go execute it. Let's find the right people, right? The next year, I worked with the Smithsonian to make a short film called Letters from Camp, which was young Muslim Americans reading the letters written by young Japanese American incarcerates from World War II from the camps. And they're standing next to a survivor of those camps, right? And that like blew up as content. I did that for years, right? And whether it was paintings or viral content or short films, that's sort of the universe in which I operated in. That really very much leads to 2020. And I am having, this is obviously 2020, everybody's going crazy. I'm having a conversation with my friend Trayvon Free, who is a through and through Hollywood figure. But we're having conversation about what I said earlier about impossible moments, right? What is a moment when society at large tells a group of people you can't do something and somebody shatters it? With everything I just said about me being in politics, with Obama impacting me the way it did, that's my OG impossible moment. So that's how we were talking about it. I was like, oh, what other moments feel like that? And I was like, look, man, I'm Asian. So there's only one other impossible moment in my life. And it's the night Jeremy Lin dropped 38 at the Garden against Kobe and the Lakers. And that started, I remember Trayvon said to me, right when he heard me say it, he was like, 38 at the Garden, that's a movie, right? And that's when we sort of started on this journey to make this fun little project called 38 at the Garden that we got on HBO, that was shortlisted for the Academy, that really has been just one of the, I mean, truly one of the great experiences of my life. I can't really compare it to like the other campaigns that I do because a film is a film. When you hit a film right, it's everywhere, mm-hmm. right? It's on a streaming platform. People are talking. So like, That very much is the experience that led me here. I was very long-winded, but I hope it gives you a good sense of who I am and my journey to doing the work that I do.
Oh, it totally does. I don't know. I feel like Matt's kind of pining there. He's like,
I don't know. I love, like, I just like hearing people's stories. Like, it doesn't really matter what it is. I just enjoy that. Like, how did you get to the place where you had that conversation, 38 in the Garden? Because we all have those experiences in life, right? Where you're like, oh, like that's something, yeah. Maybe not right now, but like it's something. And then you stew on it and you kind of sit there and you go, I don't know. You try to run it through to see if it works or like, it's stupid, never mind. But to actually get something and run it all the way through to obviously the success that you've had and where you're at now, like, that, I mean, that's cool. That's, I think that's why so many people enjoy podcasts and things like this is because I can hear that anywhere else.
And I think, you know,
and let me just clarify, I tell
people like, go ahead.
Let me just clarify because you were like, the Academy, let's just make it clear. Like 38 at the Garden is a short film. It's 38 minutes long.
Yeah.
That premiered at Tribeca Film Festival this last year, was distributed on HBO and then got shortlisted for the Oscars.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Okay,
was a lot of fun.
And while you didn't make the short list of the final nomination, mm-hmm. the amount of impact this film has had.
Yeah,
it's been so incredible to watch.
Yeah, it really has been. I think the community impact, and I think, you know, when I tell people of like the political origin story of 30 at the Garden, people are like, "What are you talking about?" And I explained the Obama thing. I explained the impossible moment thing. People get it. Like, it very much is from that construct, right? And once I do that, I think we tap into a vein that is universal, which is the underdog vein, right? And sometimes that is, well, a lot of times it's based on identity, right? A lot of times is what people doubt you can do or not. And I think that's one of the things that's really come across is, how do we take that unique doubt experience that I've had as an Asian American and make people who are not Asian American understand it, no matter your background? If you feel like you've been doubted in any capacity, right, you can watch 38 The Garden and know what matters. Just if people don't know what I'm talking about, like, Jeremy Lin was a unrecruited and then undrafted Asian American basketball player from the Bay Area who was one game away from being cut on the New York Knicks. And he checked in, like, literally, I mean, this is this time we're around the anniversary right now in February, when Lin Sanity happened. He checks into the game against the Nets and he just goes on this crazy hot streak where he culminates it in scoring 38 points against Kobe's Lakers in Madison Square Garden. This is back in 2012. And I've always felt very, very protective of that story. Mm-hmm. You know, the way I always tell it is, I didn't get to see the game in the Garden that night, but I tried, right? I was living in DC at the time and I was like, I have to see this, right? Because in my head, I'm like, okay, this streak, he had scored like for like at least 25 points a game.
Right. It was like,
how many games was it? It was seven,
but like so three of them had already happened leading up to the Kobe game. And like, I was like, okay, this is nuts. But I'm in my head, I'm like, okay, it's going to end with Kobe. Okay. Like, this is not going to happen. All right. Kobe, this is still like, Kobe's like a year off from winning his fifth championship. This is like still prime Kobe, you know? And I take the train up and I try to get into the arena, and like these scalpers, this is like before the era of like SeatGeek and Prime Time and Vivid Seats, you know, like this, the scalpers are in control.
Back when sports was fun.
So, excuse me?
Sorry. I said back when sports were fun, when you could
go. I know, when it felt a little more spontaneous.
It's just a different time.
Right. And I try to get in and they're like, hey kid, you know, like, yeah, you look like you need to be in the arena, man. You look really excited. And like, you know, it's going to cost you $700. I'm like, where? $700? Where are we sitting? He's like, oh yeah, nosebleeds. I don't know if y'all been to the Garden. And nosebleeds, you could touch the ceiling at the
Wait,
Garden.
Did you not,
I've been
did
there.
You not know I worked there? I worked for the Knicks.
I did not know. Well, no, we did talk about this after. But you worked there during Linsanity?
Right before.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know what the Garden nosebleeds look
the Garden
like. Oh my God.
Going, there is nothing like the Garden.
No, I agree, right? But I was like 26 at the time. I just didn't have the money to
$700 for nosebleeds is absolutely insane.
That's what I paid. I saw Jay-Z in the Garden and I paid $850 and I sat at the very top. Like,
worth it?
Yeah, like, why?
I mean, I guess
which tour, Matt? Which tour?
Dude, Black Album. Come on.
Oh wow.
Come on, dude. I flew to New York for that concert.
Oh my God.
Wild.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe we really are talking about Garden prices then, but like, especially for something big. But
yeah, but it's just one of those things. Yeah, dude. But like, there was so much hype on that. Cause that's back when Sports Center was like the thing that everybody did when you got home from work or you're trying to get like that was in the era where all those broadcasters, those guys were so they were just original and it was all authentic,
right?
And like watching
pre-feed culture.
And that was like my reference point for Linsanity was SportsCenter, because I'm not a Knicks fan, I'm a Laker fan, so there was no context other than like, whoa, this random guy from Harvard, right? He's a Harvard grad.
Yeah, he went to Harvard.
Yeah, like this random Harvard guy is like busting ass. Like that's really like what the context was until obviously it kept going on. So
I mean, but like legit, I
you didn't take the ticket, Frank.
I was like, look, I mean, I think part of it was because like I knew I had a good backup plan. Koreatown's right next door to the Garden. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, like I'll go to one of the karaoke bars and just I'll just plop down at one of the bars and watch it that way. And I, you know, when we started filming, I told Jeremy, I was like, looking back on it, I don't think I would have traded the experience I had for even being in the Garden.
Right.
Because you are surrounded by people who look like me.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds of people in this bar. And, you know, Jeremy scored 38 points, right? He outscored Kobe. He won the game. And like, you had 2 hours of people losing their minds, right? Their brains are being broken because, you know, Pablo Torre, the ESPN journalist, he says this great line in the movie. He says, like, Asian Americans come up with a psychological hack where we identify with people who look nothing like us, right? That's how you survive in America, right? And you look at the heroes, you look at even the villains in America, they don't look like me, right? And like all of a sudden you get somebody who breaks the hack, right? Oh my God, I get to root for this guy, right? I mean, first and foremost, that's insane. Like that breaks your brain. But the second part of it is like, you know, it takes an Asian athlete, especially in a sport like basketball, just watched across the world, it takes an Asian athlete to break a lot of the stereotypes specifically about Asian Americans and Asian people in general, which is that you're weak, you're a pushover, you could be bullied around, you're submissive, right? Like all the things that affect Asian people in the workplace throughout, right? No matter what kind of job you have, to have this kid come out of nowhere and just shatter those stereotypes on the world stage, it broke my brain. There's no other way to put it. I remember people ran out into the street after he won, after the Knicks won. Like there were people who, like, just didn't even pay their tab and the bartender didn't even care. They just ran out into the street, right? That's the kind of night, the only time I've ever felt that in my life was the night Obama was elected president.
Right.
That's it. That's it. And I, you know, I tell the story to Trayvon. Trayvon's like, that needs to be a movie. And you know what the first thing I do is I doubt it. I'm like, look, nobody cares what Asian people think in this country. We're invisible in this country, right? Like I've told stories my whole life. I mean, I just sort of told you all some of the stuff that I do, right? Like, I mean, whether it's like working for Elizabeth Warren or like doing Notorious RBG with my friends, right? Or like, you know, working on, you know, whether it's like Islamophobia or Black Lives Matter related stuff or immigration, like I'm not talking about Asian American identity, even though I obviously feel very strongly about it, but in my head and whenever I try to pitch those projects, like I'm just getting no's, right? Oh, it's too small, you know, a population, the demographics, the audience is not there, you know, I don't know if this matters the way we're having this conversation. Like, I mean, like I used to tell people, like I gravitate towards being identified as an immigrant before I identify as Asian American, because immigrant, there's like a political value in talking about immigration that way, right? Like I've always said that. And like, you know, like that doubt, it creeps in. I mean, every Asian American will tell you that they have that doubt. If you don't, you're crazy. And, you know, like, you know, credit to Trayvon, he didn't really push me. He was just like, yo, like, I'm just telling you it's a great story, bro. And I thought about it for a couple of weeks. And, you know, this is 2020, right? So, you know, anti-Asian violence is already starting to spike. And we don't know Jeremy at all, right? It's not like we knew him. He was right. A homie or something.
It's like he's
and
your like, homie. You're like, hey,
no. Right. So I was like, look, man, like if he's down and he wants to use Linsanity as a vehicle to talk about stereotypes in this country, everything I just said about shattering those stereotypes. Because like, look, if you made me describe 30 Garden without any basketball at all, I would say part one is about stereotypes. Part two is about what happens when someone shatters them on the world stage. And then part three is about today when those stereotypes are weaponized. And when you weaponize Asian stereotypes, they turn into anti-Asian violence. It's like really straightforward if you think about it, right? And that's the through line in 38 at the Garden. That's why you're not even thinking about basketball or even thinking about Jeremy at the end of that movie. You're thinking about stereotypes and when they're weaponized. And look, it took a couple of months for us to like convince Jeremy to do it, partly because he's an athlete, right? Athletes don't think like towards the front of their careers. They're trying to prolong their career. He's, you know, he's playing in Taiwan now, right? He played 9 years in the NBA, but he was like, I'm trying to prolong my career. If I look backwards, then my career is over, right? So he avoided Linsanity projects for years. And when we finally talked to him about the angle that we wanted to take, which is that we're not ending this on Linsanity. Like, Linsanity is not what we want people to talk about. We want to talk about stereotypes, right? And use Linsanity as the ultimate vehicle to, like, make sure that we have this conversation as loud as possible. Because, you know, what we were saying earlier about how, you know, Asian people don't break through, Asian stories don't break through, Linsanity broke through, right? And that's when it clicked. That's when Jeremy was like, and think about how many celebrities actually say this. That's when Jeremy was like, okay, I'll do this if it's not about me. Right. It's like, that's insane. But that's how he did
though. It speaks to his character. And I think
absolutely.
Like, also, I have the kind of honor of knowing you and Samir and Trayvon separately. Wow. Right. And so, like, you guys are all very similar in the character vein, right? There was nobody on that team that was like, this is about me. Like, everyone seemingly showed up and said, no, this is about what you just mentioned, it was stereotypes. It was shattering a stereotype and then talking about how it's weaponized.
Yeah. That, I mean, and I, you know, that's when, you know, so you just mentioned Samir Hernandez, who's our other producer on this movie. Samir, like, knows everybody in the sports world, like, literally every person. It's a little crazy, but he used to be a Jordan Brand. He produces movies now. And he's the one that connected us to Jeremy, right? So, like, before we talked to Samir, we just had this deck and we put it in front of Samir, and Samir was like, all right, let me make some calls. And I think it was Danny Green. He called Danny Green because, like, yeah, Danny Green was the only person he knew that had been teammates with Jeremy in Toronto. And Danny Green gave him Jeremy's number. And that's how we brought the team.
What's together. Danny Green up to? Did he get a credit on the film?
No, he got a special thanks.
There you go.
He just got traded.
He just got traded. I think, wait, who did he get traded? He was in Memphis now. I think he's in, I forget.
Did he go to the Clippers? But, like, I think he went
I think to it might Clippers. Be in LA.
Yeah, I think he went to the Clippers.
Yeah. Hey, I take LA over Memphis. But yeah, I mean, like, it was a wild experience. I would say Trayvon and I had that conversation, like, towards the end of 2020. I just looked this up the other day. I was like, the screenshot says that, like, February 2021 is when the deck was ready. We had our first call with Jeremy, like, April of 2021.
Okay.
And then by July, we are all signed up. Everybody's ready to go. We had a lot of trouble raising money, even with Jeremy attached. No, sorry, not raising money. We had a lot of trouble getting one of the studios to say yes.
Yeah.
Because they were just like, I don't know. That was a long time ago. A lot of people sort of just, like, said no. I mean, we could save that conversation for another day.
Yeah, but
like,
how many people do you think, and this is maybe a dual question, how many people do you think, as you were going to the market, one, mm-hmm. and also through your Academy kind of campaign experience for the Oscars, do you think people were like, oh, it's a basketball movie, it's not a movie, right? Like, that they wrote it off because it looked like a sports doc as opposed to truly what it is, which,
yeah, people didn't get it.
You know what?
You wouldn't get it.
But you know what? The other thing is, like, it's weird that you would look at it like that, because the way I look at it is, like, such a benefit that it's a sports story, because it's
people,
like,
watch sports.
Yeah. So it's, what's the conduit in the United States, right? It's like, you talk about through lines. That's what you can poke holes in a bunch of things, and there's, you know, negative stuff with sports too, but when you start talking about continuity and team first, and, like, it's like, I was listening to, gosh, I can't remember another basketball interview, but it was so interesting. It was like a race conversation, right? And it was like, when it comes to basketball, I don't care if it's NBA or if it's at, like, YMCA or, like, outdoors. It's like, if you can play, you can play. Nobody else cares. Nobody cares what
race.
It's like, can you shoot? Can you play D? Are you going to get rebounds? Like, and so, to me, having a chance to, like, learn more about that story, it's so powerful, because I think anybody can relate to it from the standpoint of, like, yeah, and breaking those things, like, doing something impossible.
Right.
Like, that's what I look at. Yeah, without the context of the Obama thing, right? For me, just as a viewer, as a consumer, it's like, oh yeah, like everybody remembers that run. Now, obviously, not maybe the cultural context that you have or something else, but like as an NBA fan, as somebody that loves Kobe and loves, you know, all of that, 100% you remember those things. And
totally.
It was such
totally.
A unique snapshot of time. And yeah, and then
I'll tell you one thing that somebody said. I won't say who, but I talked to this person after. The movie already come out, it did really well, so like, you know, it was like a little bit of like, all right, I fucked up. But like what he said was, he was like, oh, you know, we already had our Asian story slated for the year, so we can take on another one.
100%.
I was like, do you understand how fucked up that sounds?
The words that come out of people's mouths,
you can only have one.
And they used to like, they and Frank, I'm telling you, I've heard this for years. That's why I asked. I was like, not only were there was two different like containers that the story came in that were obvious. One was sports and basketball, and one was an Asian story, right?
Right.
The non-obvious was the actual story.
Yeah.
Right. Like from, and Matt, I totally agree with you. Obviously, I'm an athlete. We're all athletes and love sports in this like this conversation. But the traditional kind of like film critic or, you know, buyer in studio, it like sports really hard to sell up until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And stories of under historically represented folks, like just not there. And so that's why I asked Frank, because I'm like,
yeah, but that's changing, hopefully. Right,
because hopefully it is.
Yeah, no, and I'm not saying it's a perfect animal by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. But
the way that you can consume now, to where something like 38 in the Garden, like 10 years ago, how am I going to see that? Right,
30 for 30, and that's it.
Yeah, but like 6 months after it gets made, unless I have like the premium.
Now everybody has a movie. Now every basketball player has a movie.
You can watch it on your phone in the subway. You can, you know, it's
I was just like it was like Ja Morant has a documentary. Man, Ja, this is like your third year in the league, man. Totally. Like what?
Totally.
Right? It's like, come on. You know, it's just like, I mean, but like, look, I agree. I think it is changing, and I think sports should be, and I think it will be more and more of a conduit for us to have larger conversations, and sports stocks, it's an obvious way to do that.
I think sports and music are
yes.
two kind of universal languages.
Sure. And look, they both have the benefit of being very kinetic.
Sure.
Right. You do it right. You direct it right. You're on the edge of your seat, you know, right. and the delivery device for something much larger than just the play by play or how you enjoy the game or the music, you know, that's just much more accessible to you if you can entertain. You know, and very much like, I mean, if you watch 30 the Garden, it's a very entertaining movie. The last 10 minutes will hit you, you know, like a brick. But you know, we do a lot of entertaining before that. We have a lot of comedians in it. Hasan Minhaj is hilarious in the movie.
Some of that stuff.
Ronnie Chang, Jenny Yang, all of them.
So what's your favorite? I hate the word favorite in this context. You watch this film how many times you think? Like 400?
I can't even.
So you've seen it in small intimate settings. You've seen it in very large settings.
Yeah.
What is the one moment, one or two moments in the film that have a similar reaction, no matter who you're viewing it with? Whether that's a laugh or a cry, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's different, but I think probably the most universal is the last bit, because it's so emotional and we are hitting you in the face with it, right? Like it's about stereotypes and anti-Asian violence and about, you know, just like what that moment meant to Asian Americans. So like, it's a very emotional moment. You know, we had the music make sure that matches it too. I think it's funny to see the jokes in very different cultural contexts as well. It's not just the comedians that are funny, like everybody's funny in this movie, which is amazing, right? Like people, you know, the moment that there are two moments to get the biggest laughs, but like the one that I think is that I always wait for let's put it that way, is when he dunks against John Wall and the Wizards, and Tyson's like, Tyson Chandler, his teammate, was like, I didn't know he could dunk. And then Hassan, this is actually why I wanted Hassan in the movie, because the first time I ever seen Hassan Minhaj in anything, never heard of his name, was he made a movie. He used to do this like YouTube series where I think it was called The Truth with Hassan Minhaj. He would wear like a robe, like one of those, like, you know, like old school robes, yeah, and sit in front of a fireplace and just talk. Yeah. And the first thing I have ever seen him do was talk about Linsanity. So I was like, I want him in the movie. Obviously, it's 10 years later. He's a huge deal. At the time, nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
But like, we have this moment where I was like, I need to ask Hassan about that video. And so we cut to, you know, Hassan's like, and after that, I made a video. We cut to him 10 years ago talking about Linsanity. The way that crowd, every crowd just shrieks,
yeah,
every single time that scene comes out, because it just shows you that, like, you know, like, everybody here is an OG. Like, ain't nobody here to, like, you know, talk about things that, like, they don't really care about. Like, we cared about it for a long time.
Well, I think that's
so the there's thing. That one.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah. I think the other really funny, like, joke moment is in the beginning of the movie when we're talking about, like, how Asian people grow up in America. And we have this, like if you're, like, if you are especially of, like, Taiwanese, Korean, or Chinese descent, like, you know who David Ho is. He was, like, he was the person that you were told was your Michael Jordan. Not Michael Jordan. That guy's Michael Jordan. David Ho invented the triple cocktail that made HIV no longer a death sentence, right? He's one of those very rare, he's like him and Norman Borlaug are the two people who are probably single-handedly responsible for saving hundreds of millions of lives, right? One individual. So, like, I mean, he's, if you're an Asian parent, you want your kid to study their way to success. Like, this is MJ, you know what I mean? Like, so we have this back and forth joke between Jenny Yang and Rodney Chang about David Ho that, like, if you're with an Asian audience, it hits so hard because it's just everybody's life experience, right? It's their childhood coming back at them in a funny way. But, you know, it's sort of traumatic, too. If you grow up and you can't root for Michael Jordan, you have to root for the guy who solved the AIDS crisis. Like, all right, you know, it's a little wild. But, like, I mean, there's an animation in the movie where David Ho's, like, Time magazine cover is on a refrigerator. That's my childhood refrigerator. Like, David Ho was on my fridge, right? So to see that, like, I had an inkling that that's how people felt, but to see that really vindicated in the way that people reacted to it, I was like, oh, I was not the only one. Obviously, millions of kids thought this as well.
No, like, and just the movie for being, I love that it's 38 minutes. I love the connectivity and the marketing, like the whole thing. But there is, you do really take people on a journey, right? You bring them in with, like, humor and context, mm-hmm, and, you know, like, contextual, like, understanding that, and also, like, a lot of really phenomenal women,
yeah,
right? Not just Hassan and Ronnie, right? You have Lisa Ling, and you have, what's the name of the-
Jenny Yang. Jenny Yang.
Yeah, Jenny Yang. Yeah. Hilarious, by the way.
Hilarious.
And you really invited people into something that maybe they didn't feel a part of.
Yeah.
Right. I felt that there was this beautiful invitation, and then you feel like, okay, we're great. This is such a cool story. And then all of a sudden you see that little girl on the doorstep.
Yeah.
And I just won't, like, the last time I viewed the film in your kind of Oscar run was at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I don't know, he looked to be, he was probably 30, you know, and he seemed to be with his girlfriend. And when that part happened, he looked at her and then grabbed her hand and then just started crying.
Oh.
Right. And he couldn't stop, you know, I could see his emotional, like the veil was gone right there. The armor was down and it was like, oh crap. And Matt and the audience to get, like, context is, you know, what does the little girl say?
She says she doesn't want anyone to see her skin color.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
As you're introducing the Asian, you know,
hate section. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And And it just, and it, again, you just so beautifully kind of bring people in and then challenge them, you know, and then end it on such a beautiful, like, hope moment. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say bravo as a director, Frank.
Thank you.
Like, thank well you. Done. And like, was, I can only imagine how intentional that was, but it looks so easy, but it probably was really difficult.
It was really difficult. But it's also the part that I knew I wanted, and I executed exactly the way I wanted it to from the first day we came up with the idea. I remember saying to Trayvon, if we don't find the right pivot to talk about today and what's happening today, then it's not worth doing. So that section is the most important section because it's handled with the most care. It is the pivot. If you don't handle that pivot right, HBO is not buying your movie. Like, just keep it straight up, right? Like, you don't handle the pivot right. Like, what? Like, then you didn't do the job. You didn't do the job. So I think for us, like, we always wanted to land it that way. The part that has been really hard for me is realizing just how that section feels familiar to kids instead of something that's really traumatic. I don't know what y'all were like when you were like 10 years old, but like, I was sort of an idiot. Like, I didn't understand anything. Okay, just being real. Like, there was not a movie or any content that could make me cry unless it was like a horror movie or something. And when we were screening this, and you remember this, Courtney, we talked about this. That little kid was crying at the Tribeca screening. Right? Yeah. That has happened multiple times when we screened this with kids.
Yeah.
And you see these like 10 kids who are no older than 10. You don't know what their life has been like the last couple years. Like, I mean, like, they're going to school. Their parents are probably telling them not to make a sound because they don't want to be called Kung Flu or China virus. Like, you know, like, you're saying double mask, like we say in the movie, right? Like, and you're just trying really hard not to bring attention to yourself. That is not a way to learn. That is not a way to, I mean, like, you go to school so you can open up your brain and like dream about what you want to be, not to be afraid of being some people bullying you to call you China virus or whatever. Like, to see the way kids as young as like 10 or even younger react to this movie, like they understood it. It broke my heart. It broke me because there is no way. Look, when I was growing up in the 90s, I was growing up with stereotypes. You know, plenty of people were making like Bruce Lee hi-yat noises at me or whatever, right? Like making fun of my lunch food, like all the things that people know about like Asian Americans growing up. Like, I never felt threatened. I never felt like those stereotypes were weaponized against me. You know, I mean, I live in New York now. When I take the subway home, I stand in the middle of the station. So there's no chance anybody can push me onto the tracks. I mean, that's just like sort of second nature for me now.
Yeah.
Right. And that's been the most heartbreaking part, is to watch these kids not even blink at that section. It says a lot about the kind of kids that are growing up in this world. I mean, I feel like we're all probably around the same age, right? So same age range.
Yeah.
It was a sort of charmed. It was a sort of charmed experience growing up that way, right? Pre-internet, pre-this. I mean, I think internet breeds the hostility that we
life
have
inside. Before the internet was like, better.
It was. It wasn't this hostile.
I'll make that argument with everybody. Like, anybody and everybody and all this next generation kids, like, they got their hand on the pulse, and there's a million things that are awesome about the world right now. I'm not trying to go down that rabbit hole, but
right.
Pre-internet? Man, dude, something about
you could be bike. Kids.
Yeah.
It's, riding your bike. Yeah. And, yeah.
It was just,
you could different. Be kids. I mean, it just, I mean, I remember when September 11th happened or when the Iraq war happened, I still was sort of an idiot. I didn't know what's going on. Right. It took me to get to college for me to get like actually aware of things. And then I meet some of these people who are like about to graduate from high school now. I'm like, I don't even want to talk to you. You freak me out. You understand the whole world exactly the way it is. Right. And like, yeah. I mean, it's just, I think it's, that's the hard part about, I think, doing the work in society now is like, you know, I think the veil is, somebody's saying like the veil is gone, right? Like the veil is gone for everybody knows it. So the conversation is just more real, right? Whether we're talking about allyship, whether we're talking about seeing somebody's else's point of view, like we're not, there are no niceties anymore.
I think there's like a generational, I think we found that like in this work, you know,
yeah,
is that like there's obvious, just like in any generation, right? Every generation has its, this is how I was raised, this is what this means, I was raised right, right? Like everyone kind of has this like pride around like, when I was a kid, that was the way it was supposed to be, right? And us included. But as we were doing this work and releasing, you know, curriculum and talking about things like concepts like unlearning, right? Or like, maybe you didn't learn the whole truth.
Yeah.
You learned that was like in a book or whatever. Right. Like, it's so interesting to me. Like, how do I say this? There's the, everyone lives in their own paradigm. And I think that a lot of that is rooted in the generational experience that they had, right? And to your point, you're talking about kids that were born after the year 2000. The amount of information they've been exposed to.
Yeah.
And I sit with my niece and nephew who are, you know, 12, almost 13 and 10, 11. My mind is like blown.
But it's also like that, like I am often blown by that, but I'm also often terrified. I mean, like I think about this when I think of like birds aren't real, right? Like birds aren't real, like freak me out because all those people are young and they've lived in a conspiracy driven world where, I mean, I would say this, like people believe in conspiracy theories because they're easy answers to complicated questions. Right. And if we just have a lot of complicated stuff thrown at people of all backgrounds, of all ages now, and the youngest folks are sort of just getting exposed to that, and they haven't really worked that out. But like, you know, I remember when I graduated from college, which was 2007, and there was a poll that was out saying 1/3 of Americans believe that 9/11 was an inside job in 2007. I mean, I'm sort of terrified to make that a polling question now. I bet you that's over 50%. Right. Yeah. And I think that like that is one of the hardest things that we all have to do when we're trying to have honest conversations about really hard topics is to break through that wall that people have where they've already tried to come up with the answers for themselves. Right. Yeah, and that's what the internet.
Yeah. It's this. I agree with you 100%. I think the thing. You know, we're talking about like generationals and gaps and things like that. I think the biggest thing for me, we were forced to deal with conflict at an early age, right? And every young person, every generation has conflict, right? But when we had conflict, when you had a conflict with a peer, that got handled in real time. It didn't get handled in play dates. It didn't get handled by one parent talking to another parent. You can do this. You can't do this. You were in the jungle and like you learned how to communicate with people and you learned how to look somebody in the eye and you learned how to have that disagreement without chaos. And I think that's where we're at this place now where we've lost the ability to communicate and we're doing it in such a way that we're inundated with so much information all the time. I think we're going to be, when we're real old and gray, we'll be looking back going, wow, look at what we allowed generations of youth to go through with social media. I think we could be 10, 12 years from now, looking back on that, how unregulated of a time it is. And when you don't have the social skills to communicate in real life, what that manifests and turns into when you're communicating on social platforms or through your phone,
nuances echo chambers
of emojis and all these things. And it's wild.
It used to be a nasty note written to you, passed down the line in a classroom. Now it's a snap that gets passed around all over school.
Dude,
right? And like
what about having to call a girl's house and get a parent on the phone going,
yes, remember that?
Can I talk to Jessica? Like that was so scary. Like, and learning how to do those things. And like now it's a dick pic like on Snapchat. Like, what are we doing?
I mean, I was just reading something about how like the new generation that's like getting on social media now, where like they're adapting behavior from like cam culture, and making it mainstream, right? And I was just like, for a second when I read that, I was like, I don't even know what camp culture is.
It is camp culture.
So like you know, you're what's it called? Like chat rooms, or you know, like
like being in Discord or something where you're just like always on.
Or no, that, or like, I mean, like, I mean, like a cam girl, right? That's like a culture now, right? Like the article, I'll send it to y'all later. Like it was basically saying that like that culture is now mainstreamed, right? Whereas like even in the 2010s, that wasn't mainstream.
Oh yeah, because
like an OnlyFans culture.
Yeah, but the
OnlyFans is like a great, right. OnlyFans is like a great example of. I mean, I could probably say OnlyFans culture is now mainstream culture.
Oh,
that's terrifying to say, but it's true.
Yeah.
Right. And I think like, you know, how I'll tell you this way. I left doing the political marketing stuff for a multitude of reasons. But I think there was a moment where it was obvious to me that I needed to leave. And it was the moment when somebody handed me a comm strategy, and like on page 3, it said influencer strategy. And I was like, I need to go.
Yeah.
I need to go. I can't do this anymore.
That's a wrap.
Right. And it was like, I mean, I'd sit in my head, but I still did the work to know what's going on. And it was like half the strategy was Discord strategy.
Yeah.
Right. Half the strategy, the other half of the strategy was like, how do you create like Reddit armies?
Yeah. That community. Right?
And it's just like,
100%.
What? How do you collect people, and how do you collect data? 100%.
So how do you have honest conversations with people in a world that's incentivized for you to be cocooned, to not have that conversation, or to only have that conversation with people that you agree with? All of the echo chamber stuff that I think that we're all very, very scared of.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, I think for me, when I wanted to answer that question, I was like, all right, I have to make something as loud as possible, right? And that means you have to make content as loud as possible. And like, that's how I arrived at film. I didn't go to film school. I didn't like, you know, say I wanted to be a filmmaker with a capital F. Like I still don't, I'll be honest with you. Like I have done the festival circuit now. I've done like the award circuit, and I meet other filmmakers. I'm like, I'm not this. I don't know what to say. Like you all are like, are artists. Right. And like it, you exude that air about you. And I find it impressive, but like I'm making movies too. And that's not who I am at all. Right. And like, I sound more like a strategist, I guess, when I'm talking.
So Frank, help me understand. And I, if you're talking to somebody who's someone who doesn't think they're seen, mm-hmm, right. Like you said, you were a wallflower in high school.
Yeah.
Right. Who they want their story to mean something or to be able to do that. Like, what will you say to them, to somebody who doesn't think their story matters? What would be your advice?
I would say that the good things about an interconnected world is that you have at your disposal a wealth of stories that can help you feel seen, right? There are a lot of smaller voices, some even really big voices that you can probably look to. That can break through. It doesn't have to be sitting in a stadium watching Barack Obama speak, right? I mean, like, I think, you know, I made this this painting with a friend of mine, Eric Euler, who's an artist, a few years ago. It's called American Gothic X, and it's Yuri Kochiyama, the Asian American activist, and one of her best friends, Malcolm X. And it's the two of them standing in front of the building where they met in like that American Gothic style, right? And I remember, I mean, it's one of the things I'm most proud of. It gets a lot every single like May. It gets like shared like crazy. And one of my friends, he has a nephew who is half Black, half Asian, and just like was like, I think he at the time when it came out, he was like in high school, and he would just always complain, you know, my nephew just doesn't feel like there's anything, and he's like super. He's super into politics, super into activism, right? And he's like, he just doesn't feel like there's anything that's out there. And I was like, look, I just made this poster. Like, I want you to get it for him, right? I want you to tell him the story about why this matters and the allyship. I mean, talk about allyship. Like, that is one of the great allyship stories. Yuri Kochiyama actually is the one, the tragedy of it all. She's the one cradling Malcolm X's head after he's shot in that really famous photo. She's the person who's most responsible for getting Japanese American reparations in the 1980s. And she would say like all her lessons that she learned were from like Black activism in the 1960s, right? Like tell stories like that because they exist. No one's trying to make it up. Mm. Right. I mean, sometimes it's really hard to think about, like, I mean, Jeremy's story is crazy in that like nobody did that before. Right. But like a lot of stories that I think people can gravitate to feel seen, they already happened. Right. That's sort of the beauty of America. It's sort of the beauty of this pluralistic society that we live in. And just as long as people spend the time to like create the kind of content that people want, right? You have no idea how many people, like, I mean, like old Jewish ladies will come up to me after Notorious RB, especially because I was in the movie, and they come up to me, they're like, I feel seen. I'm like, whoa, I don't know what to say about that, but like, that's amazing, right? Like, I mean, like, it was like this running joke. It was like every single time I went to a friend of mine's wedding, and if they were Jewish, like all of like the Jewish like moms like would like come up to me, right? If they heard like Notorious RBG. And like, look, that's different for every community, right? I certainly saw this for Asian Americans, obviously with 38 The Garden, but like make good content. The stories are there.
Yeah.
Right? Make good, whether it's a poster, whether it's a viral campaign, whether it's a movie, whether it's I mean, whatever is your method of content delivery, like make good stuff. If you hit the right way, people are going to remember it forever. They're going to hold on to it because they finally feel seen. And it's not just something crappy that they read and, you know, it's like some meme that they pass around and they forget about. It's something that they'll remember forever.
And you never know how it's going to relate to others that may not look like you or relate. And I'll use the example that I told you last time. I watched the film, my parents decided to watch it at the same exact time,
right,
that we were in the theater. I texted them where we were and I was like, it's on HBO, you should watch it. I get out and there's a text from my dad, who was a very overweight kid, and you know, he dealt with that stuff, and he's like, it was really amazing, it reminded me of when I was overweight. Aww. Growing up.
Yeah.
Like I felt seen in that kind of not related to and persecuted, you know, like bullied and all those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the fact that it could hit a 72-year-old guy, you know, the 38 at the Garden could affect my father.
Yeah.
And kind of make him think about his own story at the end of that film, you know, again, bravo. And I'm really appreciative of you deciding to make this your life and your art, because we need more Frank Cheese in the world. also like spending your time with us today.
Of course. I love this conversation. Yeah. I feel like you are thinking about the important stuff and how to, I mean, I think we all agree, right? It's just, how do we make impact? I think that's always the hard question. I think this conversation was about that. And I really appreciate all conversations like that all the time. We need more of them. And, you know, thank you all for just giving me an hour to ramble. But hopefully, you know, hopefully there's something there that people can take away from.
No, thank you so much for spending some time. And it's those stories. I think the thing, you know, you're talking about producing content and how important it is. And I think the importance and the impact that this film had, it's runs through a lot of different areas, but I think it's the authenticity. And I think that's where it's inundated with content all day long. And so it's like when you can touch on something, right, that is impactful to you, it comes across so authentic, because I think there's so much now that's produced to make money or produced for wrong reasons or done in the wrong light. So when you see something, it was pretty obviously a great film.
And I think you're
gonna love it for a long time.
Thank you.
So everybody, Frank Chi, director of 38 The Garden, you can stream it now on HBO. Is there anything else you want to promote or let people know where they can find the rest of your work?
I mean, I think all of my work is at my website, which is frankchi.studio. It's Frank Chi, FrankChi.studio. I mean, I'm excited to dive into what's next. I can't share that just yet, but like, you know, it's going to be an exciting time. I'm definitely going head first. Talk about diving into politics. I'm now diving into film. So
amazing.
It's going to be a fun ride.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, sir. We'll see you soon in California.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, you guys.